This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want our veterans to know how much we appreciate their service and sacrifice. We want to hang on to their stories so they're not lost through the generations. And along the way, we sure are educated and inspired as we listen to these tales of long, long ago. Boy, are we in for a story today. It is a story of perseverance, a story of survival, and a story that had a pretty impressive adventure just in the last few months here. 89-year-old Jonas Hofer of Fresno, California is our guest. Originally not from California, but a much different climate. Yale, South Dakota. How big a hamlet is Yale, South Dakota?
Yale had 10 people, one service station, that's it. It was about 6 miles. Huron was about 22 miles. That was a Huron, so that was a pretty big town. But Yale was just a stop on the road. It was all, a wide spot, yeah.
So you say 10 people. How much of that was your family?
Well, we lived 6 miles out of town, but there were 10 people besides us, yeah. Our grammar school there was 12 people, and 5 of them were our family, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I imagine that was a pretty unique way to grow up. I know you only stayed there till you were 8, but not too many people get that experience in early school where the whole school is in one room, probably.
It was one room, and we had our school on one side of the street, and the Indian school was on the other side. So we would play them in baseball and that there, but they had 60 kids of theirs because it was a big reservation, pretty big reservation. But we couldn't go to their school, and they couldn't go to ours there. But South Dakota was a unique experience. We would trap for fox and beaver and different things like that and sell them the pelts and that and make a little money that way. And so we had a lot of traps. And then most people don't know, the state of South Dakota paid $2 for every gopher tail that you brought in, figuring that you killed the gopher. Uh-huh. And I brought in 200 one time. We had a bunch of traps, and we'd put them in a whole bunch of, and through a year's time, I got about 200 of them, I guess.
You hit it rich in the gopher trade, huh?
My brother once got a silver fox, and for that they paid $20 for that pelt. Otherwise, a beaver pelt was $3. And like I say, gopher tails for 2 cents each. I had these Prince Albert tobacco cans full of them.
Well, it sounds like a lot of fun hunting all those animals in South Dakota, but what about the weather? Because here in California, we had a cold spell a couple weeks ago, and people thought the world was coming to an end. I guess that was probably nothing for you.
Well, I never even noticed the cold weather, but it got down one time to 40 below. If there was any wind, you didn't get out in it because you'd get frostbite on your face. But in South Dakota, we had cows, about 12 cows we milked. And so we had a rope from the house to the barn. If there was a whiteout, you couldn't see nothing. So you would go by the rope to find your way to milk the cows and that. My job was to turn the separator, and that was to separate the cream from the milk, because they would only buy the cream. They wouldn't buy the, and we sold that and eggs and that, and during the year to help you get by.
And then when you were 8 years old, your family moved to Central California. What was that like for you to go from South Dakota to Dinuba, California?
Well, we had a lot of relatives around Dinuba. And so we had a lot of friends right off the bat, cousins and uncles and aunts and different ones like that. So later on, it was very good because they gave us a lot of work. My mother was a widow. My dad died when he was 48 years old. My youngest sister was 5 months old when my dad died. So my mother raised 9 of us children by herself. And in those days, you didn't have federal assistance. So we had to get jobs, and all of us worked where we were at. And I can remember from the time I was 12 years old, I would work Saturdays and different days for different Japanese watermelon guys, raising watermelons and that. And I would give my mother $20 a month. All of us did. They were older than me and that. And that kept us going. We worked packing peaches and whatever, all the work. And because of so many cousins and uncles, we had quite a bit of work. They were good to us. And our church also made, because my mother was a widow, was very good to us.
And I hear you were quite the baseball player as a young man. Is that true?
No, not baseball.
No?
No, I was more into track and like polo balling and that there after I got my back healed up.
Well, I that's what I was getting at. The back injury cut short any hopes of athletics and was pretty severe. Tell us what happened to you. You were 15 at the time?
I was 15 at the time and did one of the silliest things I've ever done. Some friends came and we got off the bus and they came up and said, let's go to the mountains and that there. And I thought, well, I've got my studies all done and that there. Okay, I went. Well, that was a big mistake in my life because I changed it so much. We went up above, I forget, in the mountains toward General Grant, and the driver wasn't watching very carefully. He got off the road, and we went down into a canyon. I was unconscious. The driver was killed. And when I woke up was 6 days later or 7 days later in the Reedley Hospital and found out then that they had the funeral already for my friend, the driver who was killed. The car is still in the canyon down there. It's so steep and that, yeah.
Wow, we're talking 70 years ago, 70 plus, and it's still down there. And I imagine there was heartbreak just knowing your friend had died, but your injuries were pretty severe too. Tell us the extent of that.
Well, I had a broken back, but my spinal cord was not broken. That was the fortunate thing. And I spent that year then in bed with weights on my legs to keep, my brother put up some gymnastics where I could hang on them and go into the bathroom and that. And then the doctor told my mother to get me some weights, and I built up with the weights. And by the time I was a junior in high school, I was probably as strong as anyone in Dynevor High School. In fact, in track, I got the trophy that year because I had made the most points at the Valley Meet in pole vaulting, discus, and the 220, than all the other guys together. So I did get the trophy that year. So that weights really did build me up, yeah.
But I don't want you to sell this situation short here, because for a while there, you probably weren't sure you were ever going to walk again because you didn't even have feeling in your lower legs.
The first 5 or 6 months, I had no feeling in my legs. So the doctor said to get these weights and build up my shoulders because I'd be in a wheelchair the rest of my life. But then through this hanging on this bar in the room and those exercises, slowly my back straightened out. And about 6 months later, I could feel needles in my toes and that. And they just, the doctors and all them, hip, hip, hooray, because they were so happy. But I had been in traction then already for 6 months, and I was for another 6 months. My sister tutored me, though, that I finished my sophomore year in high school, but I was in there until the next year, and then I went to school in crutches for a while, but pretty soon I could throw them away because of this weights and that and getting stronger and stronger, and I built up that way.
I'm trying to imagine being a teenager and dealing with that, the death of a friend, this injury that you take so long to come back from. What was it you think that helped you believe you could recover and that you would have a life to be excited about?
To tell you straight, was after I was got home from the hospital and I was in bed, our pastor came by. And he says, Jonas, are you going to come back? And I had been baptized in that 2 years before that, and that was great, in the Kings River by Reedley. And that was a high point in my life. But then I got in with the wrong fellows in high school. And I'll tell you that right now, birds of a feather flock together. And I got to be just like them. Now, we weren't into drugs or stuff like that and that, but just I was not living for the church and that. Well, when the pastor came in, He came up to, and it says, "Jonas, aren't you tired of running?" And I knew what he was talking about. So it says, "Yes." He says, "Well, would you want to come back to the Lord?" So he came and prayed with me, and then, and now this next thing I haven't told many people, because I know everybody hasn't had an experience like that. But that evening, then, I decided I was gonna, from now on, I was gonna live for the Lord, and I was gonna watch my steps in that and go biblical. Well, that night I had a vision or something. The room lit up, and to this day I don't know if it's an angel in there or the Lord or what, but it was a special. And I never had any after that any reservations about serving the Lord. When I was in the Navy, then we started the navigators aboard our ship to Houston, and had the Bible verses and Bible study once a week. So when the ship was torpedoed and we were in the water, why, we had guys, sailors, come swim up to us and ask us to pray for them. Wow. Yeah, and one fella accepted the Lord right in the water there. So then we got picked up the next day, about 14 or 16 hours later, I forget exactly what. And when we got on the destroyer USS Grayson, and my friend Herman Dwyer, he said, "Well, let's pray, let's thank the Lord." So we knelt down there, and I was amazed at the sailors all standing around, officers and men with their hats off, quiet as a mouse, while we prayed and thanked the Lord for saving us.
Well, and I want to get that whole story. At first, we got to get you aboard the Houston, and I want to dwell a little bit on these high school years, because you talked about being really good at pole vaulting, and maybe folks from outside the Central Valley don't know that the greatest pole vaulter of the 20th century was from this area in Dutch Warmerdam, a little older than you. You were there when he broke the world record?
There when he broke the record. In fact, I performed, but I was in C class. The high school had were in the morning, and I was pole vaulting then, but I had to be with the A's, B's, and the other, all the big fellas in that there. And our first height was 11 feet, we had, and I never made the first height there. But I had been over 11 feet in Dinuba already before. In fact, I got first in the valley at Delano about 2 weeks before that.
What was the best height you ever made on the pole vault?
Maybe 11 foot 6 inches. Of course, we had a steel pole.
Not bamboo, huh?
Oh, not bamboo, or these new ones they have now that spring you up over and at. You gain a foot and a half, 2 feet by them. And because of, actually, Dinuba High School didn't have pole vaulters at that time. So we went, the guys that did the pole vault, we went out and bought the pole ourselves. It was an aluminum pole. It was a 12-foot pole. But it was just stiff, no give at all in that then.
With regard to Dutch Warmerdam specifically, were you guys in awe of this guy? Because he jumped 15 feet, I believe, something like 100 times before anyone else in the world made 15.
I think that time, if I remember correctly, it was over 15 feet when he made that. Now, he also didn't have these springy types in that. He could have made 2 feet or 3 feet higher. Because he was good. He was very good. He made over 15 feet, a number of times. And he did that to break the record at that. I think it was, if I remember correctly, it was 15.75 that broke the record at the West Coast Relays.
And what year did you graduate from the Emperors there in Dinuba? Was that 42?
42, and then I went to Reedy College, yeah.
But something happened your senior year of high school there in December of 41, December 7th. The Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you found out about that?
Yes, we had been, we went on Saturday, we went up to Wolverton Ski Bowl up in the mountains. They have an ice rink up there. And there were four of us that were ice skating up there. And we had so much fun, we didn't want to leave. All the other people left, and we were still there. And finally, the forest ranger said, "You better leave if you want to get down. It's starting to snow." And we went about one block and slid off the road. And we couldn't get the car out that night. So we walked back in, told the ranger what had happened. He says, "Well, we'll get out in the morning." He says, "You guys can stay in this place. There was a fire in the center. It was warm." They brought us some sleeping bags and a radio. And in the morning, we had the radio on and we heard that Pearl Harbor had been, and that was before the president said, this day has been a day in infamy and it'll never go away. We didn't know how much it would change our life then.
And, you know, that's a question I ask every veteran that I interview, and that's the first time I've heard that kind of story, that you're camped out in the woods because your car was stuck, and that's how you found out. Did you make it to school that Monday?
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Yeah, we on the next day, they brought a tractor there and towed us out, and we got all the hills in. And that's when we heard in the afternoon that Roosevelt has said this is a day in infamy, and we're at war with Japan now.
What did that mean to you?
At the time, I didn't realize that it would change things so much. I knew it was a big difference because of war, you know, now, but I hadn't heard about Japan too much before. I had a lot of Japanese friends and that, so this was really a shocker that they would even bomb Pearl Harbor. But I really didn't think it would do as much as it did. Then that year, I went to Reedy College, and the Navy recruiters and Marine and all Air Force came around and found out if we would join. So I had already had some pilot's lessons and in flying, and so I wanted to be a pilot. So I went to the Navy, and I asked to get if I would get into the cadet program. And, oh, yeah, just science. So I took all the physicals and that, and I passed them all for Marines or whatever, because I was very strong.
Boy, it sure sounds like it. We're overdue for a commercial break, so I have to stop you there. But we're going to pick it up with 89-year-old Jonas Hofer when we come back. As if we haven't heard enough yet, we'll get to the day his ship was torpedoed and how he survived overnight into the next day floating in the water. Hometown Heroes will come right back after this. The average age of the veterans on this program is pretty close to 90, so I've seen firsthand over the years the challenges of aging, and I've realized that everybody approaches them a little differently. For some, a friendly senior living community is the ideal option, but for many of us, there's no place like home. I don't have any ruby slippers for you, but I do have an idea. Call Jason Selsler at 317 Construction, recognized by the National Association of Home Builders as a certified age-in-place specialist. Instead of giving up the comforts of home, why not let 317 Construction make your home more comfortable by making it more accessible? Jason and his crew can widen doorways, install ramps for wheelchairs or scooters, reconfigure your counters for better access, modify your shower for safety, secure grab bars wherever you need them, whatever it takes to allow you and your family to keep making your memories in the place that holds so many of them, your home sweet home. Call 905-8490. That's 559-905-8490. They say a picture is worth a thousand words, but when it comes to making my mouth water, I don't need a thousand words, just two of them. Mongolian beef. Okay, two more. Ming's Restaurant. And I guess if you want to know where to find it, I should give you two more. Las Banas. That's where I grew up. And I'm guessing Las Banas is somewhere you pass through every now and then. And if you drop in for the Mongolian beef, you might start calling it what I have for years. My favorite place to eat. Period. He may not look old enough for this to be true, but the owner, Paul Cito, has been working his magic in the kitchen there for 45 years now. It's all delicious. If you're a garlic fan, try the Baja shrimp and thank me later. But the Mongolian beef is absolutely unmatched. The flavor, incredible. The texture, tremendous. I can't do it justice with words. You just got to go taste it. One word of caution, do not go on Monday because Ming's is closed on Mondays. So pick another day, tell them I sent you, and let me know if your taste buds enjoy it as much as mine do. That's Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in lovely Las Banas, California.